All right, well, welcome everyone. This is session 253. And, all right, it is recording. Church discipline, impact on family, ward, and the larger LDS community. My name is Carson Calderwood, and I'll just be chairing this today. I'll give a quick little bio of everyone, but first, I want to put a quick reminder out there to silence your cell phones. And I found out this morning, chairing another one, if you have an Android and you slide all the things to silent but set an alarm to go off, it will supersede the silent directives and go off anyway, so don't embarrass yourself like I did. And as well, if you can, help out with the purchasing some books with some of the support here for the event. All right. So I'm going to go in order of presentation, which will go down the row here. So I'll first start off with Whitney. So she... All right, Whitney grew up in a Mormon family in Minnesota, Whitney Mollenhauer. She served a mission in Thailand and graduated from BYU. She has an MA in sociology from the University of California, Davis, specializing in gender and social stratification. Her master's thesis examined parental leave policies in Europe and attitudes toward masculinity and caregiving. I spoke with her on the phone before, and she has some really intriguing questions, so I'm super excited to hear what she has to say. Next is Christine Black. She is a sociologist, so automatically her stock went up for me. She has a PhD in religion and society from Drew University. Although not a Mormon herself, her dissertation and continued ethnographic research centers on Mormonism and specifically considers how the idea of family affects LDS congregations, so super pertinent to this conversation today. And Lori Berkman, a friend and fellow Washingtonian. She grew up in a very literal believing LDS family in the Pacific Northwest, and she currently resides near Seattle. She stepped out of correlation just over a year ago and has enjoyed growth as come as a result. She served a mission in Argentina, like I did, and graduated from BYU in 06 and has worked as a professional web designer, technical writer, editor. She has three young children and is a permablogger, Rational Faiths. Very talented. And last but definitely not least, Micah Nicolaisen, very good guy. I've talked to him actually in the past a few times too. Very warm, hearted, caring guy. He's a wedding and portrait photographer residing in Chandler, Arizona. He's an avid consumer of Mormon studies and has participated for several years in the online Mormon community as a blogger and podcaster. And that's how I first got to know him, was through some of his podcasts. And he has requested a quote-unquote court of love disciplinary counsel for himself so he can receive some extra love. So congratulations on that.
Love me.
All right. So I will turn the time over right now, and then we'll go through all four presenters.
All right, so I'm Whitney, and I decided to put cat memes in my PowerPoint because, you know, church discipline is not the most fun topic, and I mean, even if you don't remember anything else from my presentation, at least you'll be like, hey, she had the funny lol cats, so, and even though today is not actually the Saturday session, is okay. The chair, Carson. As Carson mentioned, I have a degree in sociology, so I'm a sociologist. I'm not a family therapist. I'm not a historian, so that hopefully gives you kind of a sense of my approach to this topic. So even though I'm a sociologist, my methodology was not exactly the most scientifically rigorous. Mostly my research on this topic consisted of like talking to people about their personal experiences and just sort of gleaning what I could from blog posts in the Bloggernacle and Facebook discussions. And just so it's generally kind of a sense of sort of my impressions from what I've seen and heard and read and experienced. So having said that, I'm very interested in hearing all of your experiences, if you feel comfortable sharing them in the Q&A. So I'm looking forward to that. So, okay, so I have three main takeaways that I want to talk about. So we're talking about family, the effects on church discipline's effects on family, wards, and the church as a whole. So with regards to effects on families, church discipline disrupts family relationships and can weaken ties between families in the church. And with regards to ward effects and ward processes, church discipline is a tool in defining doctrine and boundary maintenance. And with regards to the church as a whole, my hypothesis is that the end result of church discipline is it sets the church on a trajectory towards becoming more and more conservative, more and more homogenous, and ultimately possibly more and more irrelevant to like society as a whole and to outsiders. Okay, so first of all, so effects on families. It's a missionary cat. all right, so effects on families. So the first kind of intuitive thing that we think of when we think of church discipline, they take away your temple recommend, they take away your opportunities to like attend the sealings, weddings of your family members, and if you're excommunicated, they're basically saying, hey, you're not going to be with your family for eternity. So that's kind of the first thing we think of. But the thing is, like, being cut off from your family actually starts now if you, like, for many people who are disciplined, is that how you, yeah, for many people who are disciplined in the church. So a couple of things can happen. The person who has, oh, that's not what I want to do. Here we go. So the person who's being disciplined, might be ostracized by family members. Part of this may be because the family members of folks who are disciplined sometimes become ostracized by the ward themselves. So one example we've seen of this recently is with Kate Kelly's parents. They were very supportive of her, and they had their temple recommends, I think, taken away, or at the very least, they faced some kind of informal sanctions. So it's sort of this idea of guilt by association. So that's kind of crappy. So a couple other things might happen. So if the family of the accused, if they're very supportive and empathetic of the person who has been disciplined, that may cause them to lose faith in their leaders and, you know, sow the seeds of doubt and perhaps ultimately the church. From one of the people I talked to said that of the grandchildren of the September 6th, only maybe like one or two are still active. There's like 24 grandchildren of the September 6th, I think is what this person said. So that's one of the effects that we can see, is basically that family ends up, the whole family can end up leaving the church. So on the one hand, if the person if the family members think that the person was disciplined too harshly, they might leave the church. On the other hand, if the family members think that the person wasn't disciplined harshly enough, it can have a similar effect that they lose faith in their leaders. So, for example, if dad is like cheating on mom or abusive to his wife or whatever, and his family members see that, and then if he sort of just gets like informal probation or something, that can really undermine the faith of the family members. They're like, this is terrible. Why is he not, like, he's not repentant. Why is he not, you know, I think the leaders are wrong on this. So it's kind of a double-edged sword in that way. Okay, so ward level effects and processes. So as I mentioned, church discipline is a tool for boundary maintenance and defining doctrine. One thing that I think is really weird about church discipline is that, so for the most part, we know the church is very hierarchical. There's church handbook of instructions. You got to like follow the policies to the letter. And in many ways, local leaders don't have a lot of autonomy. However, excommunication, which is kind of this big thing, right? It has the potential to maintain boundaries, define, you know, who counts, who doesn't, who's in, who's out. But this is where they have all the autonomy. So it's kind of weird and backwards, and it's kind of a big deal, I think. So, for example, Elder Uchtdorf's talk, where he talks about, like, there's room for everybody in this church, if you're doubting, whatever. So that's, like, coming from one of the apostles, right? However, the Kate Kelly's leaders excommunicated her, and that, I mean, like, that has had much more of an effect, I think, on people's perception of what's okay, what's doctrine, what isn't in the church. So that's my perception, which is kind of crazy. Like I said, the local leaders, like, actually have a lot of autonomy here in this really big thing. So it's weird. So, as mentioned, so defining doctrine. So the Mormon Church is not like the Catholic Church in that Mormon Church doesn't have, like, canon or creeds that lay out specifically what official church doctrines are. Even the Family Proclamation is not considered revelation or doctrine. It's like an inspired document, I think, is what they said in the talk. The Church Handbook of Instructions also does not list, there's no official doctrine in there. It gives policies and some official church positions on how to interpret the word of wisdom or what is considered a grievous enough sexual sin to merit a church disciplinary council. But there's no statements of doctrine. Even, like, in the Church Handbook of Instructions, it mentions the church's position on evolution, and basically it says, we have no position. So the Church Handbook of Instructions does little to nothing to help us understand, define what is doctrine. So we have bishops, stake presidencies, high council members, who it's kind of up to them to define, like, well, what is doctrine and what is apostasy? Like, it's basically they're the ones deciding. So I mentioned privilege up here. Why is this? The irony is that a lot of these local leaders who are essentially defining, like, what is considered apostasy, what is doctrine, what is false doctrine, they haven't necessarily given these things a lot of thought prior to, like, the actual situation, right? So if you are a person who has privilege, like if you are a cisgendered man who has a priesthood, you're heterosexual, you're married, and you have children, you don't really have to, you're not forced to think deeply about, well, what is the doctrine, what is the truth on sexuality, on gender, these kind of things. So this is just sort of my speculation, but I feel like what ends up happening is then you have, like, the local leaders who usually don't have a lot of autonomy in anything actually have a ton of autonomy here to, you know, define what's apostasy, what's doctrine, what's false doctrine. Even though I've never sat on a disciplinary council. there's at least the potential here for them just sort of figuring out doctrine literally, like, as they're sitting on the disciplinary council, right? So as they go. Okay, so boundary maintenance. So good church members and the church is defined by how they are different from people who are excommunicated or disciplined. This boundary maintenance kind of fosters social cohesion, but in a really hurtful and problematic way. So basically what you have going on... Oh, yeah, I'm still on the right slide. What you have going on is the church sort of defines a common enemy or a scapegoat within the flock, right? Gays, feminists, so-called intellectuals, whatever. And then we cut them off, right? And through church discipline, they cut them off. They say, well, so then they're a common enemy. And then the rest of the community is like, hey, we're good, because we're not like them. We have, like, this enemy in common. It's like word gossip. Like, when you gossip with someone, you, like, build community and intimacy with the person you're gossiping with, right? However, when it ends up being you who's the subject of the gossip, then it's suddenly, like, hurtful and problematic, right? So it builds community, but at the expense of people who are on the fringes. Okay. So one more thing I want to mention about doctrine and boundary maintenance is that I think it's important to mention that even though we usually are just talking about formal church disciplinary councils, so being excommunicated, disfellowshipped, there's also what I like to call informal discipline, which kind of works the same way. So basically, yes? So that's the idea of, so it's like this never-ending process, right? When there's like the scapegoat, right? And they get cut off. So now you have like a smaller community that's, you know, socially cohesive. But then the person who is like next lowest on the totem pole becomes the lowest person. And so then they're going to become sort of the new scapegoat or the new common enemy. And then they're going to be cut off. So it's turtles all the way down, if you will, and that it's just a, this process is just never ending, right? So that's the point that I wanted to make there. So informal discipline. So bishops can take away your temple recommend, release you from your calling, make sure that you don't have any callings in the ward, and basically, I mean, it ends up being sort of the same thing as if you were disfellowshipped in many ways, even without calling a disciplinary council. So the end result is the same, even, and from what I've seen and read and heard, this is kind of what happens more when it comes to apostasy. So most official, like formal disciplinary councils, from what I've heard, have to do with like sexual sin. But with when it comes to, oh, like, I think you're teaching false doctrine, I don't like the things you're saying, they're more likely to just, you know, take away your temple recommend or release you from your calling. And I think we've seen a lot of this in response to Proposition 8 and ordained women. I've heard a lot of stories of people who, like, their bishops just take away their temple recommend, right? They don't even convene a disciplinary council. And they can do this. They have the power and autonomy to do this. Okay. So, looks like I'm about out of time, so I'm going to try to quickly wrap up. So, church-level effects. So, my hypothesis is that the church will become ultimately more conservative, more homogenous. Now, I don't want to sound too pessimistic. I'm not saying this is necessarily inevitable, or that there's no exceptions to this, but I believe that with policies and church structure as they currently are, this is going to be the overarching trend and the overarching, the general direction we're going to be moving in. So when you have this boundary maintenance of, you know, cutting off the people on the fringes like again and again and again on the ward level, when you have that going on throughout the church, basically you end up with having the same dynamic in the church as a whole, right? So because of the mere existence of disciplinary councils and, you know, the fact that, like, for example, Kay Kelly's excommunication or September 6th was so visible, they don't even have to convene a disciplinary council on me for me to, like, hold my tongue, right? Because I have seen what happens to people when they speak up. And I have seen that, well, people who think like me are not really welcome, right? So I'm going to self-censor. Something else that I think is going on here is I think there's a kind of pluralistic ignorance in which, I mean, everyone is self-censoring, right? Because you don't want to be, like, you don't want to have your temple recommend taken away, right? So you think that everyone else is, like, on the same side of the bishop, right? You think you're the only one who feels uncomfortable with a certain policy or teaching or whatever, when in fact it may be that actually a lot of people are uncomfortable with it. But because everyone is engaging in this self-censoring, people think that they're the only one who feels like that. So then they end up just, they don't even have to be excommunicated. They just leave of their own accord because they feel like, well, I'm not welcome. And, like, nothing, there's no progress happening, right? I don't belong here. Like, they've made it clear to me that I don't belong here. Okay, so I wanted to mention the disciplinary council as a microcosm of these processes in general. So you have the same kind of dynamics going on in the disciplinary council, right? Self-censoring. You don't want to be the person who's like, stake president, I don't agree with you. And some of the people I talked to who had been on disciplinary councils said that they felt like they couldn't speak up because they were, you know, they were not like the presiding authority. They were just like a lowly ward clerk. They want to be supportive of their priesthood leaders. But at the same time, they felt really uncomfortable with some of these things. And a number of these people ended up leaving the church, or at the very least, like they had like minimal activity, minimal church activity later on. So on the one hand, you have those people sort of self-selecting out, right? On the other hand, the people who are who hold the majority view in the disciplinary councils, they are going to be subject to confirmation bias in that, so if they excommunicate someone and that person ends up repenting and coming back, then it's like, hey, we were right. Like, we were right to excommunicate this person. They repented. But also, if they excommunicate them and the person doesn't come back, it's like, well, see, good thing we excommunicated them. They're not one of us. They don't have faith, right? So you end up, they end up becoming more and more convinced that, you know, they're right, that, yeah, they end up becoming more and more, they develop more and more sort of faith in the process of disciplinary councils and how church discipline happens there. Okay, so the last point I want to make is basically that because of this, because it's because of boundary maintenance and people self-selecting out, and because of demographic effects, such as Mormons having smaller families than they used to, and the fact that younger age cohorts tend to be less religious than older age cohorts, the church's growth, if it hasn't already, is going to, well, it's not going to grow very much, and they're not going to get very many converts, because again, like, outsiders are like, what, they do this excommunication thing? That's backwards, that's messed up. What, women don't have the priesthood? That's messed up. And so they're not going to be getting converts because of that. So, yeah, like I said, don't want to sound too pessimistic. This is not an inevitable result, but I think this is what we will see happening if things don't change. So that's about it. Thanks, and I look forward to hearing your experiences and your questions in the Q&A. Hello. Thank you all for being here. I know we're competing with a high-profile panel, so thank you. I am not a member, but I have been doing deep hanging out with Mormons for the past 6 years, and as part of my methodology for looking at a bigger project, I was there pretty much any time the door was open, and I kind of joke that I spend more time with the Mormons than the Mormons do. So as part of my work, I undertook the participant observation method of ethnographic explorations. I attended probably 15 different wards, conducted personal interviews with probably 75 people. So I know it's kind of a small sampling, but still gave me some insight, and have done some informal interviewing as well. So my remarks today reflect on the findings from that bigger project, and I look really in depth at things that Whitney has mentioned, especially things like boundary maintenance, and this paradigm of, you know, how do we decide who belongs. So if you would like any more information, I'd be happy to share that with you. Just come and talk to me, and I'll get your email address and shoot you some information. So my remarks today, though, are more centered on how excommunication affects communities, because I really kind of look at more congregational studies than how people believe individually. Although extremely personal, excommunication is also interpersonal, as religion and religious life is always lived in and through community. Community begins with the local congregation and extends into public space. The recent ecclesiastical discipline measures taken against Kay Kelly and John DeLynn highlight how excommunication affects many other members within the LDS Church and also influences opinion about church itself. Before I get too much into this, I just want to stop and acknowledge that any discussion like this is always a discussion about power. Who has the power, who doesn't, who is perceived as being other. And like Wendy just said really eloquently about this kind of boundaries. And so I just kind of want to acknowledge that that's kind of underpinning everything that I talk about, even though I don't talk about it directly. I suggest that there's a direct correlation between the level that members feel power has been abused and the effect that such perceived abuse has on the greater community. So I'm going to talk about congregation and then move into public space. In the LDS Church, congregations are always referred to as ward families. And that's what I originally looked at, was this idea of family within Mormonism. And I discovered that ward families are a special type of kinship network. And it's the foundation not only of religious life for Mormons, but their communal life and their life as a community. Mormons think of themselves as a family. And in cohesive, or what I label capacious, wards, they also care for each other as the same way that family cares for one another. Embedded in the LDS faith are the ideas of civic virtue, being a good citizen, and having moral obligation to care for others. Many Christian and Jewish congregations believe this, and it's a central element of being a religious person and loving your fellow being. For Mormons, this means taking care of their fellow congregants through church callings such as ward and home teachers. Now, to back up and give you a little bit of history on this, I found this was really fascinating. Beginning with the early church and continuing today, Mormons hold that the aim of creating a good society includes the habit of frank curiosity in one's neighbors and the holy enterprise of minding each other's business. It's a quote from Cross in 1950. Rather than being interpreted as intrusive, in some words, this form of minding each other's business is taken as a care, an act of care. This person is really interested in me. They want to know how I'm doing. They're checking on me. They're taking care of me and my family needs. This practice developed into home teachers, and then originally the ward teachers and home teachers became what we know today as home and visiting teachers. And this creates opportunities for congregants to care for one another, and it reinforces the notion of ward family. In capacious wards, like I said, it's an opportunity to take care of one another. But in other wards that I call obedient wards, there's a darker side to it. The holy enterprise of minding other people's business in some wards, rather than an opportunity to care for one another, some congregants feel that home and visiting teaching is used to monitor and police behavior. The new tools and a new LDS app on smartphones allows clergy, like local bishops and stake presidents, to know where you are. And some people find this a little bit too intrusive. Some people see it as a way to share information about, oh, here's where I am today. Here's what I'm doing. I want you, it's like Facebook. And some people feel like, oh, no, it's just sharing too much of myself, too much of my private life. So there's two sides to this, and following rules does have its place, and like Whitney said, it's a way of boundary maintenance, way of developing our peculiarness in a certain group, but it can also be a point where relationships can become damaged or abandoned altogether. In extreme cases, ecclesial power is abused, and systems that were initially put in place to minister becomes weapons for enforcing rules and maintaining strict membership boundaries. So on a ward level, response to excommunication. The responses are radically different in the two types of wards that I've mentioned. In the first, where in the capacious type of wards, where there's an ethic of care, congregants can reach out to one another. And I've heard stories of people tell me that when they received ecclesial discipline, people in the ward treated it as if there was a death in the family. So in other words, they brought them over food, they sat and prayed with them, they brought them flowers. There was this support. In other types of wards that are labeled as obedient, the focus is more, like Whitney said, on social shunning. So I had one man tell me that he had returned from his mission early for medical reasons, and he didn't want to disclose what the medical reasons were. So there wasn't a lot of information out there about why he came home early. He said, I just want to come home and be quiet about it. And the ward assumed that he had been disciplined. And rumor mills began. And he said that it was almost impossible for him to even begin to develop relationships, let alone maintain them. He attempted to move wards. And it was a small area in southern Utah, and his reputation always preceded him. He just found it more and more difficult to either get callings or keep callings. And again, he says dating was impossible. So he left the church for about 10 years, and he's just now making his way back. So now moving on to general church membership. People who support Kate Kelly feel that they too were excommunicated, or at least rejected by their church, with the same letter, the same disciplinary letter that she received. I speculate that this might be due to the very nature of the LDS Church, that the church is a global church where each individual congregation is part of a bigger whole, that the whole is always assumed to be working toward a common good. If one succeeds, we all succeed. The very structure of church's lay leadership supports this paradigm. The reverse could also be true, however. If one member is evicted for living his or her religious beliefs in a particular way, every other member who has that same belief system or is living the same values also feels that they are no longer welcome and there is no room for them either. This generates a general fear throughout the larger church. Suddenly, the church is seen as being more focused on ensuring that its members are following rules and being obedient rather than ministering to individuals and their faith issues. These thoughts were reflected by a woman in Canada who told me that maintaining balance between membership and supporting Kate Kelly were becoming very difficult for her to keep up with. She wondered if it was harder for women in Utah. So I'd like to hear if that is the case. So I suggest that maybe part of the reason for this, you're either with us or against us kind of thing, or the whole group comes together, we live or die together, is really part of the paradigm, the Mormon pioneer narrative that really resonates with Mormons. I know I lived through 2 weeks worth of fireworks. So in Mormon stories, in pioneer stories especially, if one person is not working well with others, the entire group suffers. In extreme cases, the inability to work together is a matter of life and death. Add to this the element of persecution, the impetus behind pioneers' flights out of the Midwest to begin with, we begin to see how banding together in close communities was crucial to the early saints. The church has never really recovered from their past, and I even like to say that in many ways it shows signs of post-traumatic stress disorder. Overreacting to situations that have even the slightest whiff of nonconformance or perceived threat to the greater whole. While these elements of persecution were the crucible that formed strong communities of the early church, they are also the elements that led the church in general to be cynical, even paranoid, of outsiders. Drawing distinct boundaries between insiders and outsiders was a good coping mechanism at the time, and it was a tool for building religious identity. Yet when carried to an extreme, paranoia is turned inward, and insiders are also treated with some level of suspicion, lest they be found to be lacking in a commitment to the group. Boundary lines that are too solidly drawn become means of exclusion and even expulsion. In this atmosphere, members will huddle closer together in their smaller groups. Some sociologists suggest that this makes even a stronger church, that strict churches are strong churches. But it excludes new members from entering. Now moving on to the general public. Sociologist Armin Moss noted that when ecclesiastical discipline is publicized, it leaves the general public with the impression that the church is more interested in compliance and control rather than in conversion and compassion. The general public is more prone to view the church as a cult rather than a Christian church. The public readily jumps to this last conclusion based on what they think they know about the LDS Church. Most recent church history would be ill-conceived crusade against gay marriage and a support of Proposition 8 in California. The LDS Church spent a great deal of money trying to recover from this. Their I'm a Mormon ad campaign was aimed at showing the general public that Mormons are just like everyone else. I think, however, that this last round of ecclesial discipline kind of put a bigger black eye on the church than that ad campaign ever put them forward. It's a little bit like one step forward, three steps back. So while the ad campaign may have had some positive effect, its recent exposure with Kate Kelly and John DeLynn discipline measures have exposed its deeply embedded gender discrimination, and it's also a harsh reminder to the general public of the church's racist and homophobic past, issues that the church still deals with. Add to an already shaky public image and highly publicized excommunication of Kate Kelly, the general public is even more convinced that the LDS Church is not a Christian religion. This last point was underscored by two separate excommunications. One by the Catholic Church on June 23, 2014, when Pope Francis excommunicated Italian mafia members for their global drug trade, criminal activity, and murder. Roughly 2 weeks earlier, on June 11, 2014, the LDS Church excommunicated a devout woman who was asking for gender equality, who wanted to serve God with her whole being rather than just her reproductive organs. Comparing the two excommunications side by side leaves the general public very confused and wondering how a church that claims to be Christian can be so heartless and so cruel. So while the church would claim that disciplinary measures are individual and not group matters, I strongly disagree. In a church that is so focused on family, community, even ward family, and caring for their brothers and sisters, church discipline, like religion itself, is experienced in community.
Dr. Vila. I'm going to speak from a first-person experience first and then try to get a bigger picture in there as well. A little background on me. I've always been kind of an outlier in Mormonism, but as far as belief goes and my interpretation of doctrine and correlation, I was pretty much as mainstream as possible up until probably about a year and a half ago. And 20 months ago, I was in the Relief Society presidency of my ward, and I didn't have to start, but my oldest child turned about 4, and I started teaching the gospel to her, and all of my own reservations were fine for me to have, but the second I started teaching it to her is when I realized I really needed to study and come to grips with the shelf that many people talk about. I had mine. It was like the Library of Alexandria at that point. So it was fine for me to have that, but it wasn't something I was about to pass on. And through that process, stepping out of correlation was a very... I served a mission for the church, and it was very hard for me to realize that so many things that I taught to other people, the church themselves knew not to be accurate. That in and of itself was really hard for me. Anyway, I came to my bishop with all of these problems. I actually printed them off in a pretty sturdy binder and left them on his desk and said, these are things I need to come to terms with. And in the same time period, I finally embraced Mormon feminism. And I also expressed this to him. And during our first meeting, which was during the summer, it was in July or so, he was very supportive. He's a wonderful man. I counted him as a friend and a lovely bishop. And he even gave me a big hug and said he could feel the spirit while I was talking. And he had no idea what I was talking about at all. But he loved me and was very supportive. And I was like, gold mine, you know. And my sister had gone through a comparable experience in her bishop. There were no hugs involved. It was bad news. So I felt very, very good about that. And anyway, until a few months later, I wrote some blog posts on my personal blog wall. I mean, all of 50 people that I'm close friends with saw it, but at least 15 of them were in my ward, and apparently that was a game changer. So this is an email I received from my bishop in September He said, "This is the sort of thing I was talking about when I said to you that you need to be cautious about what you say and post. I'm not asking you to censor yourself, but you need to understand the repercussions of the things you say and do in public. As I told you, what is done in the closet is one thing, but when it gets out into the open, I may be forced to do something, or else I may be perceived as condoning the activity." These two blog posts, one of them was showing precedents for ordained women. I don't have a profile to date, though I would. I just don't think they need renegades. They need good, strong believers. And anyway, I didn't have a profile, but I absolutely advocated for the precedence of the cause and the doctrine that would support it. And the other blog post that was a week later said, "And even if women aren't ordained, here's a healthy list of things that could be done to create greater equality in the church." So this is what he's referencing with those two blog posts. So he continues to say, and just a little bit down, he says, "Then again, there are some things stated which tend to go away from not only the instruction and counsel of the brethren, but the crux of the gospel, and that is not okay. For example," and now he quotes my blog posts back to me in the list of things I said could be changed. And this is against the crux of the gospel, just so everyone knows. "Allow women to manage and audit financial resources in the church. Instruct bishops to refrain from asking church members probing sexual questions without a woman present, if requested by the person." And I know that that's okay, but he said that that was not... currently, that's standing. You can do that, but it's not common practice. It goes on. It's call women to... Appoint women to meet with the high council on a regular basis. Create more administrative callings in the general, in the church, so that women can have their input in numbers that match men in councils of all levels of the church. I could go on, but all of them were... I mean, that's... For him, was against the crux of the gospel and meriting very firm threats. I mean, he literally said, if you continue talking like this, excommunication could be on the table. And I hope I'm an articulate person. I find myself to be one. And I responded in a very for me, the crux of the gospel would be much more along the lines of Jesus Christ or the atonement. I could even go so far as the necessity of a restoration. But what was on this list, we did not see eye to eye. And I did not back down because I didn't see that there was cause that I should have to. And I did stop going to church when I was asked to not speak at church anymore. I just wrote some blogs, and I have my Facebook friends, and I advocated for ordained women and equality of women in the church. And then, so that was September, and on December 12th, he showed up at my house on Thursday night with his first counselor. I didn't know the first counselor was coming. And he sat down, and we chit-chat. You know, they don't tell you why they're coming, so you get to figure that out about 10 minutes after they show up. And he said that he was very kind, but he said, "Now, I need to let you know that there are four statutes of apostasy," sorry, I have them right here, "that he wanted me to know about, is to repeatedly act in clear, open, and deliberate public opposition to the church and its leaders, persistent teaching doctrine or information that is not church doctrine after they have been corrected by their bishop or a higher authority, continue to follow the teachings of apostate sects after they have been corrected by their bishop or higher authority, or formally join another church and advocate for its teachings." And he told me at this point in time I was in breach of three of the four statutes of apostasy for my actions. So this is something we call leader roulette. I am from the Seattle area. And he went on to say that the following Tuesday they had discussed it, and with the area authority and with as a bishop, Rick decided that there was cause for a disciplinary action for me, and I was invited to attend, but I didn't have to. They would hold it anyway if I didn't want to go, which I thought was very gracious. So this at this point, I mean, literally months before I was in the Relief Society presidency, I am an upstanding, I swear. Okay, I'll put that out there. I have that follow. Other than that, I was a pretty good member of the church. So this... He says that, and I look at him, and I say, "You mean like a court of love?" And he's like, "Oh, yes, exactly. You're familiar with the term." And I was like, "Yes, I am." And I'm stunned. I mean, it was, and my husband is just like, but this was, he let me take the reins on this one. So anyway, and he told me that, and I said, "I just don't understand. Like, is this the and he said it's because of advocating for feminism. And anyway, so he was at my house for 2 hours that night, and I think he showed up expecting me to graciously thank him for his concern on my behalf and eagerly await the instruction that could help me, you know, join the ranks of full belief. That I had no intent of that. And he said that his hands were tied. This was all based off of what the area authority had dictated and had named ordained women as an apostate group, which is number 3 of that list. And at this point in time, virtually no one in the world had ever reported being given a court of love or even official discipline for, and this is October, this is before their first, or this is right after their first action. No one had ever been disciplined for ordained women, not Kate Kelly, not Amy Cartwright, no one. And so this, I'm just a little girl from Seattle area who takes pictures of her babies and stuff. So that was, I was like, you realize that there are bigger dogs in this fight. And he said, but you're in my ward. And this was in another email that he sent me. He said, about the posting itself, I appreciate that this is a tough thing to ask. Recall that you committed to me that you would not recruit. That being the case, I ask you to consider what your motive is in sharing something with such a vastly different viewpoint than the gospel teaches. There's plenty of opportunity to discuss and clarify points on doctrine. This, however, is so controversial that I don't see the point of you sharing it that you will ever find anyone with a like mind. In fact, outside of getting the hackles up of many of the sisters, the only thing I could see happening is that you will get someone to think the way that you do, which would obviously lead them away from the church. That, Lori, is the definition of apostasy. And that night, it was a long story. Ultimately, he left my house and I said, go ahead and hold your court. But if the point of it is to get me to repent, that's not going to be the outcome because I have done nothing to repent for. And his biggest thing was saying how, you know, we as feminists are teaching false doctrine. But the point is we're talking about the history of our church drawn from the very books that our manuals were poorly created from. And this is Mormon doctrine. This is Mormon precedent, and it's Mormonism's future. So to say that we're recruiting for our cause, it's the cause of Mormonism. And so to be held accountable for that in a negative way is horrible. Anyway, so he left my house that night, and I called my mom and told her I'll probably be excommunicated next week. He threw that out there as that's what will happen, and I knew I wasn't about to change. And I hated the idea of that. Though my theology no longer supported that as a eternally binding thing, it did for my mom. And I told her that night, and she just cries and cries, and since has told me that her deathbed, her dying thoughts will be of depression and sadness and despair for not raising her daughter in a way that she would stay faithful in the church and in good standing, and knowing that she won't see me again. the points for this discussion is how it affects the family and the ward and the church as a whole. And to hear your mom say that, when it's always been a church that was so dedicated to the family, and that's what I talked about a lot on my mission, I never knew that it did that to families, and I didn't know that would ever be directed at me. And so, I don't know, that was very hard. And it was late at night at that point, but Tom Kimball, my good friend, was online, and I was like, Tom, you will never believe what happened. And I just wanted to, like, gush about it, but he flipped out and was like, you realize you're the first woman that this has happened to for ordained women, and this is a big deal, and the press would, like, totally, the Huffington Post and Salt Lake Tribune, like, this is it, and give me the go, and, you know, they'll be there. And I'm like, it is 2 a.m. This really weird thing happened, and I still didn't think I was anyone of consequence. I guess I'm at Sunstone. Woo. But it's just weird. It's weird to have that come at you very quickly. Anyway, Kate Kelly, lovely person, called me the following morning, completely shocked, and like completely reassured me that everything that was quoted of them being an apostate group, that was all news to her, and she's very kind, and we talked, and my faith in the restoration was kaput at this point, But I loved talking to her, and I was so jealous that she truly was so believing and had such faith in this. And because of that conversation is why I don't have an OW profile, because I really value her. She's better than me in this, and I want it to be about those type of Mormon women. Anyway, so then John Dillon called me, and we talked, and he was very helpful, and we've been good friends since. And then I got an email at noon from my bishop saying, oh, all of those things we talked about yesterday, I misspoke. And he took it all back and said, I am not under any of the four tenets of apostasy. I'm totally cool and oh my bad and totally backpedaled, and that doesn't roll with me. You don't show up at my house on a Thursday night, spend 2 hours, make me make my mom cry, and then just take it all back. And so I responded and I said, no, you very clearly said that the area, you know, your hands are tied and the area authority, you had talked about me and you had prayed about it with the Bishop Rick, and I'm to show up on Tuesday or not show up. And, you know, so what changed? The area authority changed his mind. And then he said, oh, in that email that he sent when he misspoke, he said, I did further research, and a church official said that OW is not an apostate group at this time. And they reminded me I'm on a slippery slope, and every other cliche term you could possibly throw out there, Mosiah 3:19 was used. And anyway, so I did. I responded, and I said, you said very clearly that so did the area authority take that back? Did that change? And he said, that is not for you to know. All you need to know is that you're no longer going to have the court next week, but, you know, watch yourself type of thing. And I was a technical writer and editor professionally. I wrote back in bullet points this time of these are the questions that you're about to answer before we proceed in any type of ecclesiastical arrangement. And he responded and said I was being impertinent with my questions and that I needed to have more faith and be submissive like a child and have more faith in the church and authority as a whole, and noted that I've always had a problem with that. And I was like, bingo, like this is the problem. And anyway, that's how it ended. I mean, he would not give me any information and said anything. He was not in the place to divulge any conversations that happened or anything any area authority would have said. So I just responded to him and said, I no longer see you as my ecclesiastical authority. I do not want to move forward with you in any way, shape, or form. If I see you at Safeway, I will wave. Might swear under my breath as I walk away, though. And that was really hard. Anyway, I since became a blogger for Rational Faiths, which has a much bigger scope than my personal blog. I wrote about this on a post called Courted Out of Mormonism, right when John Dillon and Kate Kelly, which happened to the day 6 months after the bishop came to my house. So anyway, how would it fix, I'll try to, well, I don't want to take up too much time, I probably already have, but how would it fix the family is I died to my mom that day, because though I'm not currently excommunicated, I'm still the same person that was, and I don't know, that's really hard. That continues to be hard, and my other siblings, you know, they don't want their kids to be influenced by me and my crazy egalitarian ways. And as for the ward, I think the biggest thing to touch on here, and for the church as a whole, is often if the person's a believer and they're excommunicated, I mean, that's the worst thing you could possibly do to someone. I'm totally okay if the church comes out and says, we don't agree with Lori Ball or Lori Berkman, that's my maiden name, or Rock Waterman. I'm totally fine if they say, we do not agree with these people. They do not fall in line with what the church claims. But to ever have excommunication on the table, to sever my baptism covenants, I mean, those were not made about Joseph Smith and the Restoration. Those were made to Jesus and temple covenants and sealings, to have that even on the table is a horrible injustice and is a huge indicator of what the church has become. That for me is only control. There is no court of love. It's a court of control. That's where that ends. And it sucks to be at the receiving end of it, even though it didn't actually happen. But I would have had a heyday had they actually done that. So anyway, and for those who do not believe, this is the worst part. For me, I'd be like, well, I never would want to be excommunicated, but had it happened, it would have punished my family. they wouldn't have punished me at that point because my theology extends far past that. But for my mom and for my siblings and for those who love me and my friends and those I serve my mission with, that's who it affects the most, and that hurts me the most. So anyway, that's all I wanted to share.
Hello, my name is Micah Nicolaisen. I have zero credentials or education that qualify me to speak here today, but looks like I'm going to anyway. One thing I wanted to start off by talking about, and probably the sociologists here probably know much more about this than I do, but a few years ago I read a book by René Girard, and it was about mimetic violence. And basically his theory is that humans have a need when they gather in groups, communities, organizations, they have a need for what he calls mimetic violence, which is essentially, you know, think of, for example, like a public hanging, you know, in like the 1800s. And, you know, even though a lot of the people in the community may not have a direct connection to that person that's being executed, they will pile on the pressure of the community on that individual, and the act of violence or death upon that individual relieves the tension valve in the community, and that it serves an important function. And you know, we see that we still see that in our modern society today, like with very high profile you know, criminal cases. Think of like O.J. Simpson or, you know, any of the other more recent ones. And, you know, and whenever there's sort of an act of violence, whether it's physical violence, mental violence, that's wrapped up in an institution, when it's institutionalized, it can serve as this sort of mimetic device for the community to relieve pressure and tension. I think in a lot of ways, excommunication, like what we're talking about, can be sort of a release of the pressure valve, especially, you know, since, you know, speaking specifically about Kate Kelly and ordained women, you know, that's something that has been thrown in the face of mainstream Mormons so much over the past few months. It's popped up in the news a lot. And so to have Kate Kelly excommunicated is almost, and I'm going to, you know, theorize that it serves a similar kind of purpose for the community. Doesn't make it okay, but anyway, I most of what I want to talk about is how excommunication affects the community. One thing I do want to kind of clarify, and when I shouldn't limit it to excommunication, church discipline, which is what we're here to talk about. I do want to make a distinction that Whitney also made between excommunication for apostasy versus excommunication for other sins. And I, you know, to be honest, I don't know whether I buy into the whole, you know, excommunication for example, fornication, but I know a lot of people that have been excommunicated for that. And as when it happens to individuals who are believers, I think it can be a very therapeutic and beneficial thing for the individual if they honestly believe it's part of their repentance process. I do not see the value. I see the value to the institution for excommunicating for apostasy, but I don't think it's ultimately beneficial for the community or for the individuals or for the wards. And that's specifically because excommunication is an act of violence, just like what Lori explained. It may not be an act of physical violence, but if you're a believer, it's an act of spiritual violence. It's an act of mental violence. And especially in the context of people, individuals like John DeLynn and Kate Kelly, it is also an act of censorship. And I've gotten to lots of arguments with people about whether or not that's true, because obviously Kate Kelly has the freedom to continue to say whatever she wants, and so does John DeLynn. But and so technically, it's not a form of censorship to excommunicate somebody, but in practicality and reality, it is. And anybody who's involved in Mormon culture understands that when you excommunicate, disfellowship, or do anything like that to an individual, it delegitimizes them to the rest of the community. And it does essentially silence them. And that's why you always hear guys or people like Greg Prince advocate for advocating for making change from within the institution, and that it's much easier to, you know, affect the herd on the edges than when you leave the herd altogether. And so the problem that I have with the church doing that is because, like Chris pointed out, there is the church still goes through a lot of time and effort and money to present itself as this diverse, inclusive religious community, and then it turns around and does stuff like this. And so, for me, it just feels that I have a strong sense of justice, and so I don't like that the church can do that they can present itself as this, you know, pluralistic community, and then on the other hand, you know, use excommunication as a way to silence people. And a lot of what I'm sharing are just kind of my kind of general thoughts. I don't really have an overarching theme or conclusion to come to, but maybe these are just things that we can kind of talk about a little bit more when we open up for Q&A in just a second. Boundary keeping is important for all organizations and communities. And this is something that I've heard John Larson talk a lot about. I know Jan Shipps has remarked about it, that, you know, any kind of religion or community has the right to decide who's in and who's out, who stays and who goes. We have that in our, you know, embedded into our government. We have it embedded into really our sociological makeup. And so, you know, does the church, is it okay for the church to say, if you follow these things, you're in, if you don't follow those things, you're out? I think they do technically, but my problem with it is, and I'm just going to speak for me personally, I come from pioneer stock on both sides of my family. I didn't choose Mormonism, okay? I did not choose this community. It didn't choose me either, but it's just the way it is, you know? I didn't choose to be raised Mormon. I didn't choose to, you know, I didn't force the church to withhold historical facts from me. I didn't ask the church to discriminate gays. I didn't ask the church to marginalize women. And I think, as sort of a side note, the thing that frustrates me the most with engaging with people who are more conservative and more towing the company line is they act like the burden of proof is on me somehow. You know, like, I've got to show why the church should ordain women. For me, I don't think the burden of proof is on me, because I don't claim to speak for God. I don't claim to lead the one and only true church in the world. And so the burden of proof isn't on me to prove why women should be equal within the church, why gays shouldn't be marginalized, why gay marriage should be allowed in the church. I feel like the burden of proof is on the church to explain why it shouldn't be, you know. And so my point in all that is just to point out that the church has a right to maintain its boundaries, but I don't think it's fair. I think those people like me, people who have a hard time but didn't choose this community, should have a seat at the table when those boundaries are being discussed. And that's what I've tried to do with my local leadership. I've tried to say, hey, here's a middle ground where I can meet you at and still participate, but there's no budging on the other side. There's no compromise. Going along with the conclusions that that Whitney brought up with the how this is going to affect the church in the long run, I think cohesion, obedience, conformity was a very useful organizational tool, especially after being led to the West. We had our own area. This was our land, and cohesion was a part of survival in that land. But fast forward 200 years, it's a completely different landscape that Mormonism exists in now. And organizations that aren't flexible don't stand a good chance of being, of having a lot of vitality in modern society. And so pluralism helps organizations be flexible. And when you are using excommunication and church discipline as a tool to silence leaders and movements, like other panelists have pointed out, it sends a message to the adherents to that they are not welcome here. And that curbs pluralism. And so ultimately that results in sort of fundamentalism, which is not flexible and is not... I'm just saying it doesn't bode well for the organization. There's a lot of red flags going on. And maybe that's fine. Maybe one day it'll just be, you know, Boyd K. Packer and his buddies, and that's the church, and, you know, that's great. But I love Mormonism, you know. I think Mormonism has a lot to offer the world of theology. I think Mormonism has a lot to offer the world of Christianity and society at large. But the things that Mormonism chooses to focus on right now, I think, aren't helpful and beneficial and ultimately undermine the individuality and pluralistic spirit that's at its heart. And just to plug what I'm doing right now, I helped organize a mass resignation that happened last week here on Pioneer Day. And then the thing that I am working on right now is a new project called Strangers in Zion, where we are encouraging people to request a disciplinary council to their local leaders rather than resign or kind of more passive forms of engaging with the church on these issues. And so I sent in my request June 18th, and I currently have my disciplinary hearing scheduled for August 17th in a couple weeks. We feel like if we get enough people to do this, there's a potential for important messaging to happen within the community. For example, if a majority of the people that participate send in requests for disciplinary hearings, but they are ignored or rejected, it begs an important question for the organization. Why are you excommunicating people like John Dillon and Kate Kelly, but not excommunicating these other people that believe and say and do the same exact things? If the requests result in further excommunications and further acts of discipline, it compounds and inflates the story to make it to make it more demonstrably unjust, which is what ultimately causes the church to change, is when it feels pressure and embarrassment from the outside world. And that's my presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Micah. Great way to round that up and bring it together. And Lori, I want to give you hugs.
Hugs, thank you.
That was heartfelt, and it's eye-opening to see that because it's kind of a closed system, and so you don't get to see that a lot. And thank you, Christine, for those. I love, as like I said, I have a minor in sociology. It was my major, but I love it. And I love seeing non-Mormons give like an anthropological view of us. I love seeing that reflected, like, what do you guys see? And so that was amazing and way to start us off there with some great insight. So wonderful panel. We're going to start off. We have until 3:30, so we have about my clock.
21 minutes.
Yes, plenty of time for questions. So two questions per person limit is what we'll do. Just kidding. I would like to, you can light up, ask questions here, but I'd like to start off and then I'll go sit down and until the end when we close this off. But Ali Isom in that well often referenced interview she had, she talked about discipline, the root word of discipline coming, or a disciple coming from discipline. And as I've thought about that, I see there's two definitions of discipline. And growing up, I always thought, I want to be a disciple of Christ. That means discipline. I need to discipline myself, control myself. It seems like she kind of spun it and took the other definition, which is to like do an act of punishment, and was using that towards the why Kate Kelly needed and deserved her disciplinary council. And I hate using the word court of love. I like the court of control. I believe you said that was good. So I was wondering if any of you guys have any thoughts on that. Like, discipline definition of control versus an act of punishment on this process. So thank you.
Are these...
I think it falls in with my theories on obedient families, that or obedient ward families, that this idea of obedience really is a double entendre there. This idea of discipline as a disciple and control and power. So I think that's kind of an excuse that is used sometimes. It's like, no, we're just making you a better disciple of Christ by disciplining you. I think that that's kind of part of the, at least what I've seen anyway.
It's going to hurt me more than it hurts you.
Exactly. Yeah, it's like that. And then they...
you make me hurt you.
Yes, exactly. Don't make me come back there, you know. It's like the... And I've even had people use that type of parental language, and they infantilize the person rather than minister to the person.
Thank you. It's a semantic distraction.
Mm-hmm. I personally, I love the child. Yeah, I was told multiple times I need to be childlike, and referencing the fact that I have a 1 and 4 and 6 year old at home. That, you know, how if they're doing stuff that's not going to lead them to happiness, you know, this you, but I would never kick my kids out of my family, especially when what their heart's content is to be an equal member of my family, or that they just don't understand the family dynamic in a way that makes them feel close to me. That's the last thing I would ever do. And so I mean, I kind of said before, I mean, I'm totally okay with church leaders admonishing people. Heck, if you have to make it public, I get it, because it is a community. I do feel it needs to be protected, you know. And I definitely think that that they have the right as an organization to protect themselves from hooligans. But at the same time, like, I think that the mode of that, if you're going to set it up as heavenly parents and children, this is just extreme. That's like breaking out the whip for stealing a cookie, and it's not how we roll in my house. So I'm anyway. That's what I wanted to add on that.
Yeah, sure. I remember early on in my faith transition, my wife's sister using a parent-child analogy and just saying, you know, if your kid ran to the street, would you softly ask them to stop? No, you'd yell at them. Say, stop! Don't go into the street. The child wouldn't understand why. It doesn't understand the danger. And I said, yeah, but what if you never ever met your parents, and instead they had this spokesperson that would show up, and then they are the ones that yell at you, and, you know, you have this epistemic distance from this individual. But sometimes that same guy that yells at you tells you to do stuff that's complete nonsense. And so it's like, I'm like, I get the whole parent-child analogy, but it doesn't hold up well to scrutiny when we're talking about the church. And so that's always my critique to that whole use of that, you know, rhetorical device.
I have one more thing to say on that that made me think of.
Again, with the parent-child, like, if we're supposed to be like children in our approach to Christ and religion, my children, they ask questions. That's their job. And it is my job to answer those questions sufficiently that they understand. And then 6 months later, their worldview, they've grown up, and that question has evolved to a new form of that same question. And when I don't have the answer, I fully expect them to ask their dad and ask their teachers, or you know, Bill Nye the Science Guy. I fully endorse that. And so when I'm told at church that I need to be childlike, I have children. I mean, 4 and 6 year olds ask a lot of questions. And so when I hear that, it's a green light for me to ask questions and to find my place in the world, that it makes sense. And especially if it's a familial situation, to feel the love and security. And that's all I had ever hoped for. So
do we have another question?
I got a question.
I'm sorry, I don't want to cut you off.
Oh, no. Something.
This work?
I think it's working.
Hello, testing. Hello. Okay. I'm an LDS blogger, have been for years. I'm currently under Bishop Rick. All right, Bishop, he's trying to get me to change, okay? Let's put it that way. I've already met with the stake president, and he's already said, you're not an apostate. Keep working with the bishop. The problem is, as I write about things that are important to all of us in this room and our community, it doesn't resonate with the majority of church members, meaning they're more orthodox conservative and they have a difficult time entertaining different ways of thinking. I just have an open question for anybody. How can I, as a blogger, relate better to people who, because when they see what I write, they say, he should be disciplined, he should be excommunicated. That's their knee-jerk reaction. How can we intelligently bridge that gap and reach out to people who I think should be listening to what we each say? Okay, that's an open-ended question. Anybody can shoot for that, okay?
Well, if you've been listening to church PR, it's all about tone.
Yes. That's what my bishop says.
Right?
Yeah.
No, I do find, personally, I don't mean to grab the mic so quickly, sorry. But I definitely find that at first I was all excited about my truth bombs of, you know, the things that changed me so radically so quickly. And no longer is that a priority for me. I honestly just want people to see me as a person. I think is the most important thing. There's a reason I started out saying, like, I was a Relief Society, you know, in the presidency very not long ago at all. The second that people can really identify that you are a member of the church and that your beliefs aren't, you're not trying to project them on anyone, you want an honest, open dialogue and to always give somebody else their space to share and actively try to learn from them. This isn't a one-sided, I mean, it can feel really, because everyone else seems like they already know the same thing and what you have to say is the different thing, you know? But that's not true, and I mean, it can feel that way, and then I shout. But I've really realized that the more I'm willing to listen to them, the more they're willing to listen to me, and we realize that we actually have that common ground. That's harder to do in a blog post, but I have definitely found that the more I can make it universal, and we're all on the same team. It's not us versus them. You wrote a blog post about that, Sarah. It's not us versus them. I'm a Mormon every bit as much as they are. What I'm trying to do is working for the betterment of Mormonism. And just because that doesn't match their view of the betterment of Mormonism, that I need to have that space and to always allow that space to everyone else.
The other thing I loved about that Radio West interview was when Sister Isom said that, that there are venues, basically alluding to that there are venues in the church where you can talk about these things, which is nonsense, right? She says in her ward in Kaysville that they're talking about the feminists and the gays all the time, I guess, but not my experience growing up in Davis County, Utah. But I actually wrote a blog post for Rational Faith just about this. And I remember when I was really, really fresh in my faith transition, I basically gave myself away as sort of a non-literal, believer to a guy that would eventually become my Elders Quorum president. He just freaked out and wouldn't talk to me for a year and a half. And it reminded me of the movie Inglourious Basterds. I don't know if any of you have seen that movie, but it's basically Quentin Tarantino movie about this plot to kill Adolf Hitler in the High German Command in a movie theater. One of the characters is a British spy who's also an expert on German cinema, so he speaks fluent German, but he's got a weird accent. And they do this meeting in this tavern, and they end up surrounded by all these German soldiers, and they start picking up on his weird accent. And they're like, what's this accent from? And they're kind of suspicious of him. And he's like, no, I've come from this little village at the bottom of this mountain. We all talk like that over there. And he's really trying hard to, like, cover his tracks, so they don't suspect him as being a spy. And he's wearing an officer's uniform. And so finally, after the tension seems to be going down in the scene, he orders three scotches from the bartender, and that's what gives him away. Because Germans, they do three like this. And so that one little thing gave him away as an outsider to them, and then it turned into this bloody bloodbath of a scene in the movie. And so I feel like as people who are not as mainstream and more of Mormon misfits, like most of us probably are, I think we tend to do that a lot. We sort of give ourselves away, and that signals to somebody that, you are not really one of us. And so transcending that's the fickleness of language is really a hard thing to do, you know. And, you know, I think there are some people that are really good at doing that, like Joanna Brooks. Joanna Brooks is really good at her tone and her use of language to be appealing to both sides. And so, you know, I don't have any suggestions for you. I'm just saying I feel your pain. It's a common problem.
Can I just make a comment? I realize this isn't my forum to plug my book, but I do have a point to make about it. It just came out. It's called What to Expect When You're Excommunicated, The Believing Mormon's Guide to the Coming Purge. And the point I want to make is particularly on the Strangers in Zion movement. Or anyone who's facing any discipline, the thing to expect when you're being excommunicated is that they will violate church policy and scripture every step of the way. You've got to be ready for it. You've got to hold their feet to the fire. DNC 2080 says all transgressions in this church will be dealt with according to scripture. They're going to go using the CHI. You get to call them on it at every step of the way. You don't let them, just don't let them do it. And object constantly. You can read about it in my new book. But what you get to do is realize if it's important enough for them to prosecute, it's important enough for you to defend. And if it's usually these things will take place on a Saturday morning, make it take all day if you got to keep their feet to the fire. They can't throw you in jail for contempt. You just constantly object and remind them if they're going to use the CHI, then you ask them, are you excommunicating me from the Church of Jesus Christ, or are you excommunicating me from the corporation? And if you're excommunicating me from the Church of Jesus Christ, then you go to the scriptures that Christ has revealed, and you stay away from what the lawyers have done. Okay, I've gone too much on
myself. Hey, Rock, is that on Kindle?
It just came out on Kindle.
Okay, good.
It's only on Amazon. I don't have any copies here. I had to buy this myself.
One thing I would add to that I really wish I would have done that night, which seems extreme. I really wish I would have recorded it. In that 2 hours, there were some pretty big things that were said to me, like the only way you could stay in good standing in this church is if you put your head down, stop reading about the things that you don't need to know about, don't talk about it, and shut up. Oh, and fall in line. That was how that ended, and fall in line. And it was a heavy conversation. And things that I don't think that man ever would have said in any other context. It's when he felt he needed to act like a bishop and there was pressure put on him to act in that way. That is not his natural inclination at all. I mean, really, really, really. So I do wish that I would have recorded it. And had I gone in for a court, I would have recorded it. And for me, that simply shows, or have it in writing, a lot of things in writing. If they're going to be saying such serious things, they need to be serious enough to put it in writing or allow you to record it. And I think had I done that night, it would have probably ended there, because according to that email, you know, he was pretty ready to backpedal if he thought he was wrong. And so the things like that is just let them know that you're taking this as seriously, and you have pieces in this game too. You're not being acted upon. It should be a two-person show. So that's just that's what Rock made me think of that. So
just want to say one thing quick that I've realized as we've listened to this today. I've sat on this morning councils at both the high council level and the bishopric level, and I won't get into those experiences today, but what you have helped me see is the bigger issue is the culture of fear and the culture of fear that we have in the church, that the disciplinary councils are the macro end result that is invisible. But we all have heard of experiences online of the person who's typically the male who's learned the stuff about the historicity of the church and is now having a faith crisis. His spouse goes to the bishop and the bishop says, divorce him. Or the spouse looks at pornography for a couple of times and now he's an addict and he needs to divorce her. In my own case, I recently got divorced from my wife after 26 years. And one of the issues she claimed for the divorce was I went to a non-church sponsored men's weekend to get sort of an initiatory Robert Bly type, beat the drums in the woods type thing. And she felt threatened by that and went to our state president, who supported her that this was against church policy, and then held an intervention with our seven adult children. Dad's going apostate. And so that, I'm sorry, the emotion. So that type of attitude of even our own family members sometimes will turn against us because it's the church who will keep them safe. And if we go off of the path, that fear overrides any commitment they feel to us because they have this greater commitment to the church. And that's the insidiousness, I think, that we're talking about, that the excommunications and the disciplinary courts are just the higher level public show of what is a more insidious cultural thing that is just painful.
Wow. Oh, we love you.
Hi there. Just a quick question, maybe a to lawyer, really. So I've got a situation at the moment where a decision has been made against me around ordinances for my children, not being able to perform ordinances for my children.
Oh, yeah.
And so I took it to the bishop, to the state president, and the decision still stands, so it's like a stalemate at home. So I'm curious how you got your bishop to change his mind. What caused that? Do you know it at all?
All I can guess was he anticipated showing up that night and a certain thing happening.
Yeah.
And I told him that was not going to happen. And I pointed out any and all precedent for, one, why I am not an apostate, first off.
Yeah.
And what Rock pointed out, too, if you have the scriptures behind you, like, they have a church handbook.
Yeah.
But if you're speaking from a place of love and authenticity and maybe your Mormonism doesn't match their Mormonism, but they don't own that, you know? And I really think that that's the best you could possibly do is, and I said it before, is showing that you're a real person and where your views are coming from.
Yeah.
And I mean, especially in the history of the church, you could almost always find support there and examples. And more than likely, whoever it is that is... on the opposite side of your situation is unaware of why what you're talking about is actually well within the boundaries of the church. That, I think, is what happened to me. And I think that's what's happening all over the place. We have lay leadership that are not trained. I mean, they're trained. I know that they're trained, but they didn't go to school for this. And I think that that's the biggest point, is just taking a more active role. They aren't the ones that are in power. It's, and I mean, at some point, I suppose they are, but it's what you bring to the table, and the more authentic you can make that and the more substantiated. Either way, you'll walk away knowing that you threw down. You know, you did all that you could do, and that's all.
There were no strings pulled or anything like that. It was just...
I honestly do not know what happened between when he left my house and when he sent that email. But I did let him know that I have powerful friends. I don't know. I was like, this isn't going to end with me, and I'm not the type that's just going to let this happen. So that might have been it, but I honestly don't know.
All
you can have his email address and ask him. He loves to talk about it.
Thank you. All right, everyone, that's our time. Can we give another round of applause for everyone? Excellent. Thank you. All right, and with that, we will conclude. Thank you.